Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, to ask a question, press star 1 on your touch-tone phone and record your name at the prompt. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Amy Montgomery. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Tamara. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the quarterly UN Technical Assistance Conference call, and thank you for your attendance today. We have with us from DMH, Ms. Leanne Reinert and Mike Pelletier, and from the Collaborative, Pat Palmer and Cheryl Masalunas. There are no announcements to be made at this time. I will be turning the call over to Ms. Leanne Reinert. Leanne, you may begin.
Thank you, Amy, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I am going to be reviewing some policies and presenting some new information related to the activities of our agencies that are helping us with EDAs in our crisis care systems, Region 1 South and the Northwest Crisis Care Systems. There was a communication alert that went out announcing that that was what we would be doing at the top of this call, so hopefully all of you got that message, we were trying to encourage providers that do not do EDA services to wait to call in, so you wouldn't be wasting your time with information that doesn't apply to you. And we certainly are hopeful that all of our EDA providers did join us today. It sounded like from the number of lines open that we do have our EDA agencies represented. I am joined, as Amy said, by Special Assistant to the Director, Mike Pelletier, who oversees the crisis care systems, and he will be available along with me for question and answers at the end of this presentation. On Thursday, February 21st, we sent out a communication alert to each of our EDA provider agencies regarding this call, as I just said, and that alert also included an attached document that was entitled DMH Crisis Care System EDA Training. Hopefully that has been shared with you if you are not the person within your agency that receives communication alerts directly. If not, please check with your administrative staff who do receive the communication alerts to get that document. It will also be available on our DHS DMH provider website. The links are not yet active there. We will send out a communication alert in the near future when the link to this PowerPoint for the training today is active on the website. And in addition, we've made some revisions and updates to our policy and procedure manuals, and those will be posted in the near future. So we'll send out a communication alert once all of those links are active on the website, so that you are aware that they're there. So if you have the training document, I would ask you to please turn to that now, and we're going to begin with those few slides. The first thing that I wanted to do was just a quick review of what our intentions were when we created the crisis care systems. This isn't anything new. I'm sure that you've heard it in previous trainings, but I thought that this was a good place for us to start and give us some context for further discussion today. When we went about the work of rebalancing our mental health system, and a part of that was closing a couple of our state-operated hospitals, Singer and Tenley Park, there were a few things that we wanted to make sure happened. Of course, as with any other service within our DMH system of care, we wanted to be sure that it was focused on individualized person-centered services, that those services assist individuals in their own recovery and integration into their home communities. We want all of our services to be guided by the tenets of trauma-informed care and for the services to be outcome validated. That's true of all services that we provide or that we reimburse within our system of care. There were a couple of additional things that we really wanted to focus on with our crisis care system. First of all, we tried to design it with incentives to intervene in crises or potential crises at the earliest opportunity so that we could minimize exacerbation of symptoms and problems for individuals, as well as what we see as a system that at the point in time that we were designing it really relies too heavily on more restrictive and more expensive services and more expensive levels of care. We also wanted to try to make sure that community-based services are provided in the most normalized and least restrictive environments possible, so that over time we see a reduction in presentations to community hospital emergency departments for mental health and psychiatric services, and that we see a reduction in mental health institutional, hospital, and residential treatment admissions, with that shift going to earlier interventions in community-based services so that people are able to be living in their own homes, and we see a reduction in crisis incidents and needs for hospitalization and those more restrictive levels of care. So that was our intention as we looked at designing our system. We knew that there would be some challenges in implementing that. The first of those being that there was a lack of infrastructure. We had areas within those regions where there were not any staff designated or trained to respond to crises in the emergency departments. We had several hospitals where the emergency department staff were the ones that were assessing individuals that came in and making referrals directly to the state-operated hospitals, and our community mental health centers were not involved at all in that process. So we knew that we had places where our community mental health centers staff might not have any relationships at all developed with the emergency room physicians or other staff working in the emergency rooms. So we knew that we needed time to build those relationships, to establish trust between the emergency room staff and our community mental health staff that would be coming in and doing those really expert assessments and providing that expert consultation to the emergency department staff and in determining what was the most appropriate level of care for each individual person. We knew that there were emergency department physicians that would be pretty insistent that individuals needed to stay in a hospital level of care because of a perceived risk management issue. And so we knew that those were challenges that we were facing as we were trying to develop this system. Also, prior to implementing the system, our DMH clinical staff did analysis of a sample of records from the Tinley and Singer admissions, and this showed that there were a number of individuals that had been admitted to the hospitals that could have been more appropriately treated at a lower level of care had they not been admitted to the hospital. So this was further reinforcement of our belief that we were headed in the right direction in trying to restructure and rebalance our system in a way that allowed for more community-based care. So when we started looking at developing the system, we used the projections from that analysis in developing our contracts with agencies. It was never our intention to simply replace the state-operated hospital beds with community beds. Instead, as I've said a couple of times now, we really wanted to rebalance the system and to make sure that more appropriate community care was provided when that was available. Since the crisis care systems have been in place now for a few months and we've been able to start looking at utilization patterns, we are seeing that our projections have to this point not been realized. The utilization of hospital level of care is exceeding projections based on the analysis we had done of the population and what the service needs were. And the utilization of lower levels of care is far less than what we had projected or expected it to be. We have had discussions with agencies providing our EDA services, and we hear that they need support from us in referring to the lower levels of care, that they are finding it difficult when they're in the emergency departments to actually make those referrals to lower levels of care, even when they believe that they might be the more appropriate level to refer to. So because of those things, we have been in internal discussions, and we've made some revisions to policies. We thought it was important at this point in time to review and clarify some information, and then also, as I said, we've made a couple of changes that we want to share with you today. So as you know, our policy and procedure manual includes severity of illness indicators, it includes intensity of service indicators, as well as exclusionary criteria for each of our levels of care. I want to spend a little bit of time clarifying with everyone our exclusionary criteria for our CHIPS services, because again, this is the level of care that we are seeing overutilized based on our projections on the population. The first exclusionary criteria that I want to talk about is the individual's response to current treatment reflects that a less intensive or less restrictive psychiatric treatment program would not be adequate to provide safely for the individual or others or to improve the individual's functioning. What this means is that if an individual can be safely maintained and effectively treated at a less intensive level of care, then authorization for reimbursement of a higher level of care will not be provided. The other exclusionary criteria, as we call it for CHIPS, would be an individual has significant medical conditions which are poorly controlled or potentially life-threatening. So if an individual is in need of hospital-level medical care, then CHIPS will not be reimbursing the hospital stay. The next one, the individual has been diagnosed with serious mental illness but is not experiencing an acute exacerbation of the illness which would require inpatient care. So certainly there are individuals that if you look down the list of diagnoses that are covered by CHIPS, they are always going to perhaps meet that medical necessity criteria. But if they are not in an acute exacerbation of their illness, they do not need to be in the hospital, and we will not be authorizing reimbursement for CHIPS for individuals who meet that criteria. And finally, if the primary problem is social or economic, such as homelessness or family conflict, or again, one of physical health without a concurrent major psychiatric episode that meets the criteria for the level of care, then those people would be excluded from reimbursement by CHIPS. The next thing that I want to talk to you about is a new policy that we are implementing, and it's related to the LOCUS instrument. As I'm sure you're aware, LOCUS is a validated, empirically based instrument. Our providers are expected to administer it according to training. DMH has offered multiple train-the-trainer opportunities over the past several years. We've been using LOCUS now first with specific types of services and then expanded it to all registrations about three fiscal years ago. So it's something that all of our providers have been trained on and should have good experience with by this point in time. When we first rolled out the crisis care systems, we included LOCUS, but not in a completely not completely enforced way. I'll put it that way. We included LOCUS in that for eligibility into the crisis care system, an individual had to demonstrate a level of care need of at least a 4. But we did not use the additional level of care information in the way that LOCUS was really designed. And again, we were aware that at that point in time when we were rolling out the crisis system that we needed some time for transitions and for relationship building with emergency department staff. And so we didn't want to be placing our EDAs who were trying to build those relationships with emergency staff in the position of also having to defend the LOCUS instrument or explain it to the emergency department staff at that time. However, again, we are hearing from our EDA staff that they are now ready for this next phase of actually working with emergency departments as individuals are presenting not in need of hospital level of care, but with one of the other levels of care that we're funding in the crisis care system. And so in order to more fully implement our original intentions and consistent with the design of LOCUS, we are now instructing the collaborative that we expect them to utilize the recommended level of care scores that correspond according to the LOCUS tool. This means that level 4, which is also called medically monitored non-residential services, will equal acute community services. The intention of ACS is to provide the intensity and frequency of service necessary for individuals that do not need hospital level of care. So very similar to ACT services. And again, this level of care of 4, this is what's required for an authorization for ACT services as well. So this will correspond to an ACS level of care. If an individual scores, their composite score equates to a level of care recommendation of 5, that, again, equates to medically monitored residential services, which in our crisis care system means our crisis residential services, either mental health crisis residential services or in Region 1 South, where we also have the substance abuse crisis residential services. Either of those would be the services that would be indicated by a level of care score of 5. For a level of care recommendation of 6, which is also called medically managed residential services. This relates to CHIPS hospitalization as well as state-operated hospitalization. So we are instructing the collaborative that they will only authorize reimbursement for hospitalization if the individual's LOCUS recommended level of care score is a 6. Of course, ACS will also always be authorized for individuals that go to a higher level of care because we expect that the aftercare services to occur. So if a person has a level of care recommendation of 5, they could be authorized for one of the crisis residential services and ACS. If they have a level of care recommendation of 6, they can be authorized for CHIPS and also authorized for ACS. We expect that there may be some emergency departments who still are going to be a little bit reluctant with this new policy. So I wanted to just take a minute and remind you of the appeal process. There is no change here. This is the appeal process that has existed since we implemented the crisis care system. We have had a few appeals, not many, but because we know this is a change, we want to make sure that everyone's geared up in case they need to access the appeal process. Again, the appeal process really has 3 phases. The first phase involves the EDA as well as the clinical care managers of the collaborative. If the clinical care manager informs the EDA that an individual does not meet medical necessity for the level of care authorization that was requested, and the EDA discusses with the emergency department and the emergency department and or the EDA want to appeal the decision, then they can initiate an appeal by informing the clinical care manager that that's what they want to do. Once that happens, the clinical care manager calls the state-operated hospital physician for the hospital that is assigned to the area the EDA serves, and the clinical care manager provides clinical details based on what on the information that has been shared between the EDA discussion with the clinical care manager. Then the state-operated hospital physician will contact the EDA and the emergency department physician to discuss details of the individual case. Then the final phase, the state-operated hospital physician will make a decision and will inform the clinical care manager at the collaborative so that appropriate data tracking can be completed and any authorizations that need to be done can be done through that system, as well as the EDA provider will inform both of those parties of the decision. Whatever the state-operated hospital physician's decision is final in regards to the appeal process. So this concludes the information that we wanted to share with you today. I want to thank you for your attention. A reminder that the PowerPoint of information that I just presented, as well as the policy and procedure manuals, will be posted to the DHS-CMH website, and we will send you a communication alert as soon as those new links are activated. And we will now take questions, first related to this presentation, and then following answering all of those questions, we will make an announcement that we are opening up the question-answer session for our regular UMTA questions for any of our additional providers who may have joined us during this presentation. So, Tamara, if you could please remind the callers of how to ask a question, we can move into the question and answers at this time.
Thank you. We will now begin a question and answer session. To ask a question, press star 1 on your touch-tone phone, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name will be required to introduce your question. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Please wait a moment for incoming questions. We have a question from Ms. Teresa Good. Your line is open, ma'am.
Thank you. Are we starting to turn in the openings for NCCS again? We were instructed to stop that.
Your phone kind of faded in and out. I don't know if that is the case for other people. You asked, are you supposed to do what for NCCS?
Turn in the openings. We were in, wow, that is bad. We were told to not turn in any openings to the collaborative, and I just didn't know if this changes. Have we supposed to restart that?
So you're talking about the registrations?
I am. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Cheryl, are you still on, and do you know if the collaborative system is ready to accept registrations yet for NCCS? Or Pat?
I think I'd have to defer that one to Pat.
Okay. Pat, are you on?
Yeah, I am. Sorry. So I'm
know that there was an issue with the two program codes and anyone that needed to be registered on the, under the NCCS program.
Yeah, and that's the Fund 551 that is up and running.
Okay. So registrations can be done?
Can be done on 551, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so does that, so is there a rule now that the locus has to be with that opening, or is the locus just need to be in the chart?
You need to be reporting the locus scores at the time that you are getting the authorization, the initial authorization, because the collaborative clinical care managers must have that information, and your locus level of care recommendation must match with the clinical presentation that's being provided and must match with the level of care that the authorization is being sought for. And that's not anything new. We have always required that a locus be completed as part of the EDA assessment. That
correct,
is our,
but we haven't. I don't think that we've required that it be sent in with the registration. So is that registration requirement still the same? I know it has to be done, but we didn't have to send it in with the registration.
So how was that reported in the past?
Must
how did you verbally report it?
Yes.
Anne, it's Michael.
Okay.
You're registering clients into the NCS system.
Well, I'm not now, but I'm told that I can.
Hang on. You register them into the NCCS system in a manner in which the same manner that you register any other client into the system.
Correct.
That's all you have to do.
Okay, then I don't need to put in the locus.
And then when we tell you that the 5.5 system is up and running, we think that may be up and running, but we're hearing problems with the providers still doing that. But you can attempt to register and update clients into the NCCS system. And is this still Teresa?
It is.
Okay. If you have problems with that, another provider said that they were having problems and that they weren't able to get into the 551 dropdown, only the 550 dropdown. So you can restart submitting registrations and updates to registrations as of this moment. If you have problems, please email me. We are not accepting any claims information, however. So it's just registrations and updates to registrations.
Okay.
The 551.
Okay. And we do it in batch, so we might not have a problem with the drop-down box. But we'll try. Thank you.
Let me know if you have a problem.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Mr. Tom Hermes. Your line's open, sir.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. I understand that the utilization of hospital level of care is exceeding projections. And I'm not quite sure then, does that also include the crisis residential? Because we're being more restrictive with crisis residential as well. I'm not sure how that relates to the hospital level of care exceeding expectations.
No, Leanne, you want me to take that?
Sure.
No, the overutilization that we're seeing is only specific to inpatient level of care into CHIPS.
Okay, but we still want to have a more restrictive threshold to get into crisis residential. Gone to level 5 now.
It needs a locus score of 5, which is the evidence-based standard, yes.
Okay. And then I had another related question. When you mentioned the utilization of hospital level of care, are we saying that the CHIPS funding is not adequate for the CHIPS hospitalizations? Or
what we're saying is that we had a projection based on our initial analysis, and that projection is malutilized in terms of one hospital may be overutilizing care and another hospital may be underutilizing care, but that the projection in general we think is being overutilized as a sole source of recommendation.
But that doesn't relate then to whether the CHIPS funding is adequate or not.
We monitor our funding as we go along, Tom.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Ms. Annette Love. Your line's open.
Good afternoon. One of our first questions is, how soon is this enforcement of the locus recommended level of care? I understand it's immediate, but for, you know, supervisors to have time to just inform the clinicians, if items are submitted right now at 2:15, will they be rejected, or is there going to be a cutoff time that we can instruct the clinicians on ensuring that the appropriate level of care is selected before the CHIPS recommendation goes in.
Thank you for that question. I overlooked a very important statement at the beginning of the presentation. All of these policies are going to go into effect on Monday, March 4th. We knew that certainly not every member of your EDA staff could stop what they were doing to be on this call. So we want to make sure that providers have time to share this information with their staff. So the policies related to LOCUS will be in effect on Monday, March 4th.
Okay. Thank you very much. And then I have one last question. Regarding the appeal process, I still have clinicians that struggle with the hospitals already having a petition and cert completed for a patient. And so what I've instructed them to do is complete their assessment. And if their recommended level of care is, say, a 20, which means ACS, but there's already a petition and cert completed, to go through this process as far as calling it in for the off, having the clinical care manager reject it, and then if the hospital still wants to appeal, then going through that appeal process. Is that the most appropriate way to handle when petition and certs are already completed for a patient?
Well, certainly a doctor has the right to do a certificate at any point that they want to, and a person may be brought into the emergency department with a petition already completed. Yes, your EDA assessor should complete their own assessment independent of any knowledge of whether a petition certificate is completed. They should make their own determination of level of care based on the locus and based on their clinical assessment. If they do not believe that the person actually needs hospitalization, they may want to inform the emergency department of that even before they make the call to the collaborative. But certainly if they make the call to the collaborative and the person doesn't meet the level of care, then the authorization is not going to occur. A reminder that what the collaborative is authorizing is DMH reimbursement for care. So if an emergency department physician maintains that he's done a certificate, he or she has done a certificate, and is going to send the person to a hospital to be admitted, the doctor has every right to do that, but without DMH authorization for payment, DMH will not be reimbursing the care. So they are two different things. You are looking for authorization for reimbursement of care. And DMH and the collaborative, as an arm of DMH, will reimburse care if it's what is appropriate according to the assessment of the providers we've contracted to make those assessments.
Perfect. So, thank you very much.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Ms. Christina Santiago. Your line's open, ma'am.
Hi. I actually have two questions. The first one kind of rides on the tails of the appeal process. I guess I'm confused why the EDA would start the appeal process. If we're usually my assessors are in line with what the collaborative says, so if and not in line with the client being on a certificate. So my question is, we are to begin that? Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes, because you are the line of communication between the clinical care manager and the emergency department. So
okay.
What you are doing is you are informing the clinical care manager. Perhaps your EDA is actually disagreeing, but I would
okay.
think probably not. If they've done the locus and they've got a recommended level of care, they're probably not going to argue against themselves. But, you know, you are that link of communication between the emergency department and the clinical care manager. So you're going to inform the clinical care manager, then the appeals process is started, and it goes through its process. You know, you're going to, I'm sure that if the clinical care manager tells you, no, we can't authorize CHIPS, this person would be appropriate for crisis residential, you're going to go back and have a discussion with the emergency department physician about that and see if they're willing to do it or not, right?
Right.
And if they are willing to agree to that level of care, then you still have to talk with the clinical care manager about crisis residential and, you know, the authorization work that's involved in crisis residential and helping to facilitate the placement at crisis residential. So there's still work that would have to be done.
Sure.
If the emergency department physician agreed with the lower level of care recommendation. So we see the EDA as being integral to that whole discussion, and since the clinical care manager isn't there on site and the EDA is, that's why the appeal starts with the EDA. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense. And just one more question then.
Okay.
I'm looking at, you know, the level of care here, and yes, I see that ACS is 20 to 22 and the LOCUS score. But if we have so, that means that if someone has a 17 to 19, even though that is high intensity community based services, they could not get ACS.
Okay, probably. Now remember that there are two pieces with the LOCUS. There's the composite score, which is
right.
The numbers you were just talking about, the
right.
18 to 19 and the 20 to 22. Then there's the level of care recommendation.
Okay.
And sometimes a person could have a lower composite score, but based on one of their first three domain scores, that could kick them into a higher level of care recommendation.
Okay.
Right?
You're right.
So we're not talking about the composite score of LOCUS. We're talking about the level of care recommendation.
Got
of
it.
LOCUS. So it's important
okay.
to keep that in mind first of all.
Okay.
But yes, the very first piece of determining eligibility for the crisis care system at all is that the individual has to have a level of care recommendation of 4 or above. That's
okay.
be eligible to be a part of the crisis care system at all.
Okay.
Okay, so if an individual is in the emergency department but their LOCUS level of care recommendation is a 3 or lower, they're not considered a part of the crisis care system.
Okay.
You may serve them with your non-Medicaid benefit package. You may suggest that they go, you know, for some other type of social services, but
mm-hmm.
they would not be a member of the crisis care system.
Okay. That makes sense.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Kate Fort. Your line is open.
Actually, a piece of it was just answered. That was part of my question regarding the independent placement criteria on dimensions 1, 2, or 3.
Okay.
Is it that the independent placement criteria is a 4 or 5, like bumps them? I'm sorry. So that independent placement criteria does apply when we talk to the collaborative, correct?
Yes, because that's how you determine level of care.
Okay. And they are being trained on that, correct?
The collaborative staff are all trained on LOCUS, yes.
I've had some experiences where we've had some disagreements with the collaborative about those, so it's good to know that we're going to be on the same page with that.
Okay.
My other question was about the appeal process. We have appealed decisions before, and it has not been our experience that the collaborative is the one that calls the state hospital. Is that a recent change, or has it always been that way?
That has always been the policy. If I don't know if you have you know, something specific that you want to, you know, relay to us in general, and this is across the board for any time that there seems to be a disagreement between what our stated policy is and what happens. If you can provide us with details of the time of the call, the name of the person you were talking to, then we can track it down because that's generally a training issue because the collaborative is aware of what our policies and procedures are. The collaborative is on this call with us. So if that doesn't happen, then you need to let us know so that we can intervene and the collaborative can deal with, you know, the training issue.
Thus far, the collaborative has been overall. They've been very polite and very kind to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually typically after hours, and we will have people who are out of state and aren't as familiar with the way things work in Illinois.
Sure.
But we will connect with you later on that if that is an issue.
My
other question that has just kind of come up through this discussion regarding level of care, we get kind of stuck in a bind when we have people who are recommended for medically monitored residential because they don't meet the criteria for medically monitored residential, but it's a voluntary program. And we get kind of stuck when we have people who don't want to go to the MHC, but there's still a level of risk where we don't feel comfortable with the medically monitored non-residential or ACS. Do you have any recommendations for us? Any thoughts on how we can manage that? Or we can actually save that for another call. In case anybody has other questions about the presentation, I apologize.
No. That's fine. The way that medical necessity criteria works in general is that if a level of care, if the recommended level of care is not available, then the next higher recommended level of care is authorized. However, what you're talking about isn't really that the level of care isn't available, it's just that the person doesn't want it. So what my recommendation would be as a clinician is that if you're doing the assessment of an individual, and as you're going through that assessment, you're getting a pretty good idea, probably, if you've been doing it for a while, you're kind of getting in the back of your head, okay, they're going to meet this criteria for locus, they're going to meet this one in this domain, and you can kind of click through, okay, they're probably only going to meet medically monitored residential, not medically managed, okay? So I need to start my discussion with them about going to crisis residential, right? And so you start that discussion with them while you're still doing your assessment. And if in the course of doing that, you continue to have the discussion and they're very adamant that they don't want to go, then you may want to spend a little bit more time talking through risk factors with them to determine, are they really going to maybe meet a higher level of care in the risk of harm domain? Because what you're really telling me is you don't really think they're safe to not be in a medically managed system if they're not in a medically monitored system. So I would spend a little bit more time making sure that your risk assessment has completely considered all factors. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you. I can talk to my assessors about that.
Okay.
That was it.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Denise Klibino. Your line's open.
Hi, we have crisis workers in our emergency department. Do you want crisis workers to complete a locus on every patient who comes through the emergency room psychiatrically?
It is a requirement if the person is in the crisis care system, and if you identify a person as potentially being in the crisis care system and you're going to call the collaborative to get an authorization for a level of care in the crisis care system, that they do a locus. And that has been the case, that's been the policy all along for both Region 1 South and Northwest crisis care.
Denise, where are you from?
Mount Sinai.
Yeah, see, this is one of those hospitals that isn't in the EDA program.
Okay.
The only way Mount Sinai has the ability to access CHIPS or crisis residential services is that if you initiate a call for a transfer to Madden, and if Madden wishes to deflect that admission from Madden to either a CHIPS hospital or to a crisis residential or substance abuse program, Madden can make that determination and give you that authorization.
We receive CHIPS patients at our hospital from Region 1 South.
Right. Yes, you do.
So if we get a CHIPS patient from Region 1 that we need to send to Madden and then they are deflected?
The only time you would get a CHIPS person from another hospital and that would be, and that you would be deflecting that person to Madden is off of your unit.
Okay.
Unless, I mean, there could be an outlier case that somebody came in and, I don't know. But the only way you would be bringing a person from, it would be a CHIPS to Madden, would be off your unit.
Okay.
You should be receiving referrals from other hospitals, and if you have a bed available, then you can accept that person as a CHIPS with the authorization number.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Danica Walker. Your line's open, ma'am.
Danica, if you're talking, you're on mute.
Sorry, I'm going to go ahead and ask the question for Janika. What am I lying on? Open? Is my line open?
It's open now.
Okay, great. Okay. She was trying to run back to her desk. I'm sorry. The question she had was if a patient has, say, a 5 on the risk of harm item on the locus,
uh-huh.
but the other items may cause them to have a composite score that maybe falls into a level 4, but their risk of harm is significant enough to warrant hospitalization. Her question was, would that trump this new rule, or are we still just sticking with what this says? It has to fall under level 6 for a hospitalization.
Okay. The answer is neither of those, actually. Again, this goes back to the discussion earlier about we're not talking about the composite score. We're talking about the level of care recommendation. And there are certain scores in certain domains that automatically bump you up to a higher level of care once you complete all of your scoring of your domains and you take the grid and you look at the grid. And if you're talking about the risk of harm domain where the highest score is a 5, then that is an independent qualifier for the higher level of care. So so that it's not in conflict with the new rule, because our rule has to do with the recommended level of care, not the composite score, the recommended level of care. So if she's scoring it correctly and she looks at the 5, then that's automatically going to bump the person up to the level of care they need in order to protect them from harm.
And thank you, because we heard you answering that question and we weren't sure if that was the answer. So thank you.
I show no further questions at this time. Again, to ask, press star 1 on your touch-tone phone, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name will be required to introduce your question.
Thanks, Tamara. And I would also like to make the announcement that if there are folks on the phone that have questions outside of the crisis care system utilization management, that they can start asking those questions at this point, too.
I show no questions right at this time.
Okay. Well, thank you then, and I'll turn it back over to Amy for any final words of wrap-up.
All right. Thank you very much, Leanne. If there are no more questions in the queue, then that will conclude our call for today. I would like to remind the audience that today's call audio will be posted under the Provider Resources heading. That is on the Provider Information page on the Collaborative's website. that will be in MP3 format and available for download within 2 to 3 business days. And Tamara, you may now push the speakers through to post-conference and disconnect the main line.